Hello, and welcome to this week's episode of Aquadocs, the podcast that keeps you up to date on all things aquatic medicine. I'm your host, Michelle Greenfield. This week, I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Robert Martinez, owner of Aquatic Veterinary Consulting in Utah. Dr. Martinez had a non-traditional route to the aquatics world and discusses the importance of always being open to anything and everything and being willing to read from the textbook if you want to succeed. Plus, we're going to discuss an epic, or should I say, electrifying case about Frankie, an electric eel. And if you're listening to this on publishing day, I am currently sitting for the Navli and racking my brain for pig viruses, so please send some positive vibes my way. But in other news, welcome to Aquadocs, Dr. Martinez.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. I'm so glad because we got connected through my presentation for one of our sponsors, AAFE, the American Association of Fish Vets. And it's amazing because you have such an interesting path to aquatics. So I really want to start this episode by going through that in a way that hopefully some of our student listeners can see how there really is no one right path to this field.
Of course, I went to K-State for vet school. When I was there, my goal was to become a zoo vet. Come fourth year, my wife, she was working with Old Navy at the time, got an amazing job promotion to move to Iowa, to Des Moines, which is about 4 or 5 hours away. So at that point, the whole residency internship route kind of got blown out of the water. So at that point, I had to talk to my advisors, my mentors, and kind of switch gears. And this is my second week into clinics. I already had my whole fourth year set up for zoo. So I knew I wanted to do aquatics. So I actually got into AquaVet. I did AquaVet 1 and 3. And that's where I got the majority of my base for aquatics. Moved to Des Moines. I got a job as an ER vet as my primary job. Still wanted to do aquatics. So I contacted anyone and everyone who would listen to me for any kind of aquatic work. And I ended up getting in touch with Dr. Starling from Iowa State. He works mainly with aquaculture. And he's really helped me figure out what I wanted to do. And he really pushed me to start my own mobile business. So him and my old practice manager, Paul, helped me start Aquatic Veterinary Consulting. I was able to basically make it a side business. And the nice thing is since it's not my main job, it's a lot of fun. So people would contact me through my website, and then basically I would drive to their house. In Iowa, I mainly worked with saltwater fish. Then my wife, again, got another job promotion. So that took us to Oklahoma City. In Oklahoma City, there was tons of koi ponds. So I worked with a lot of koi ponds while I was in Oklahoma City.
So when you're in Oklahoma City and you just started working with these koi ponds, where did you get the basic knowledge for that, having only done AquaVet before then?
So a lot of it's AquaVet. A lot of the other part was CE. As you had mentioned, we got in touch through the American Association of Fish Vets. I attend a lot of their online meetings. It's a lot easier for me to do the online ones. I'd love to go in person. And then also books. If you were to look at a lot of people call it the Noga book. It's all beaten and torn up. I have tabs all in it because I am opening that book constantly. There's water thrown all over it. So I use that book constantly because every time someone calls me to come see a case, a lot of times it's the first time I've seen it. So I'm putting a lot of groundwork beforehand. So for a lot of these koi fish, even though it's kind of like dogs and cats, you know, an animal's an animal, but there's always going to be certain things that you have to set yourself up with. And a lot of times, since it's just me going out to see it, I like to make sure that I do all my legwork to make sure that before I get out there, I at least know semi what I'm going to do and what I'm going to say.
I think it's really cool what you're highlighting there, because so much of what I'm told in school is, here's this dog and cat, here's what you need to learn.
I find with especially exotic medicine, you have to think outside the box and you have to be willing to try certain things. And there's times where it will come back to bite you. And there's other times where you'll be like, oh, that worked. Whenever I was in Des Moines, I worked at the Blank Park Zoo and trying to sedate a 40-pound red-tailed catfish. I got the idea from a story that Dr. Strema told in AquaVet. So I take a lot of what I learned from other places and extrapolate into what I do now.
Oh, I definitely want to hear the story. Can we get the Spark Notes version?
Essentially, we had a red-tailed catfish come from Tennessee to Des Moines. They got their measurements wrong for this poor thing. This 20-pound catfish is actually about 35, 40 pounds. So when it got to Des Moines, it was pretty beat up and had some torn dorsal fin and then at the left pectoral fin. So the plan was just to repair the damage. So the question is, how in the world do you sedate a 40-pound catfish? Because they thrash around. They're strong animals. So instead of putting a bunch of MS-222, which is the anesthetic that we use to sedate them, in this large pool, because I mean, that would just took tons of it. Dr. Stremma told us the story of whenever he was at one of the aquariums, a benthic shark, meaning that it laid at the bottom of the tank. And those that lay at the bottom of the tank have these little holes in their head called spheres. And that's what shoots water down into their gills so they don't have to actually swim around. So he got suited up, went in the water, and then he had one of those bug spray sprayers, put concentrated MS-222, swam over, and then just sprayed that into the sphere. So I had that same idea. I got a 60 mil syringe, put in MS-222. Then what we did was we put a tarp in the water and called him Louie at the time, moved Louie up to us. And then I put that red rubber right into his operculum. And then I just started spraying it in there. And then it worked out perfectly. You can give them injections, but trying to give something that large an injection, it would just be too much work. And also the injection was going to last way longer than I needed. I was able to get the procedure done, woke up great, things like that. Just thinking outside the box of what you can and can't do. Probably one of the highlights that I can remember of working with Louie.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing. And I can totally picture that, and super cool that you were able to apply a story that you heard once and actually make it possible.
Oh yeah, no, that was really cool.
But now I'm really excited because we're going to talk about a case that you worked on with Frankie the electric eel. We haven't talked about eels yet on the podcast, so I'm super excited to learn about electric eels. So can you start by just telling us about Frankie and what clinical signs were presenting when you first started treating him?
Of course. So I'll never forget the email I got on Frankie. So it was in October 2020. And initially what they contacted me about was that Frankie's tail was up in the water column. So basically his head was at the bottom and then his tail was raised up, I'd say about 2-3 feet up. And it was just mainly his tail. So they sent me a bunch of pictures. And of course, whenever people send you pictures, they're always like, well, what do you think it is? And as a vet student or someone who even works at a vet clinic, you probably have had this same experience with family members. My dog has this. What is it? So of course, you can't really tell much from a picture. So that's kind of where we start talking and trying to figure out what's going on and getting a history. So kind of background on Frankie. He was obtained by this aquarium back in June. And it was a wild caught. And most of these guys are wild caught in South America. So initially, whenever Frankie first was obtained by them, and they noticed that he was kind of scratching sometimes, or what we call flashing in the tank, where he just rubs up against the substrate or rubs up against the decor or on the walls. So they were thinking that he probably had a skin issue. Now, this aquarium was small. So a lot of the times the health is taken care of by the aquarist or the staff. And I've noticed with a lot of aquarists, they like to wait and see, which isn't a bad idea because you never know. They just kind of waited, and then they added some stress coat to the tank. So a stress coat is basically, it's an additive that you can add to the water. Stress coat is supposed to alleviate mucus buildup. A lot of times they don't really have what medications are on there. A lot of the medications that you used to get over the counter are supposed to be outlawed. You're not supposed to be able to get them anymore. But if you go to a fish store, which I did probably 2 weeks ago, you can still find things like metronidazole that's on there. So not everything's been taken off the shelves necessarily, but you'll see that stress coat is a big one that a lot of people will use. Anytime that they feel like their fish are stressed out, a lot of people throw that in there. Does it help or does it not? Who knows? Does it hurt? Possibly not. It is not a make or break.
Gotcha. So this aquarist decided, wait it out, add some stress coat, see what happens.
Yep. Essentially, because sometimes you wait it out. A lot of the times is it just they're acclimating and things turn out fine. Well, let's see. They got this in June. In August, they started noticing this worm started coming out at the very end of the tail. And they said it was kind of like a 24-hour process. It's a very weird history.
Yeah, this is gross. I don't want a worm coming out of any animals.
Exactly. So this is long, non-segmented round worm. They didn't have the exact measurements because it just kept inching out. And then by the time it fully came out, they lost it. So we assume either the eel ate it or it went somewhere else.
Well, that can't be good if an eel is going to eat a worm that just came out of it. I feel like that's always, that fecal oral transmission is always what happens with parasitic infections.
Exactly. And so this just long worm started coming out and they have pictures of it. And the one thing that they noticed after the worm was gone was that wherever that worm was, there was these little like markings. They, in their notes, they basically call them worm trails. So after this happened, they gave Levamisole, which is a kind of a dewormer, into the water. And they said that the scratching and flashing all improved and the worm trails, so to speak, went away. So they thought, okay, perfect. We're all done. Well, within a month, they started noticing that the tail started raising up in the water column. And by the time they called me, the tail was all the way up to the top. And at the top of the tail on both sides, it looked almost like raised veins is the best way I can describe it. And they were just really inflamed and real puffy looking. And they were just sitting right at the top of the water column. So with any case, whenever I got the history, I always ask about water quality because you want to know, is there something that changed that could have caused this? According to their records, everything was within normal limits. And then as far as diet, he's been mainly on shrimp and tilapia. They've been adding in vitamins into it. And then garlic. And garlic is basically an immunostimulant. So it's supposed to help kind of boost their immune system. So that's kind of where I was starting off at. And then at that point, I was kind of like, well, geez, I have never worked with an eel before. And then two, I've never seen something like this before. So essentially, first thing I did was I started looking up things on just eels in general. First thing I found out, electric eels aren't true eels, which is very interesting. They're actually fish. They're freshwater teleosts. They're obligate air breathers. So they have to go up and actually breathe from there. These guys are basically known as neotropical knife fish. They're basically a type of catfish. So basically, they're not a true eel. So the first thought was whenever I saw that tail up was, is this a swim bladder issue?
That was my thought too. And we've talked about swim bladders before, but they're there to help with buoyancy for these animals, right? So if they need to go up in the water column, down in the water column, it's really how they're able to move.
Exactly. So the one thing with aquarist, they're just like owners and they're highly knowledgeable on a lot of these animals. And the one thing I've noticed as a veterinarian is that I have to kind of win them on my side. So initially, the first thing is I said, oh, well, I wonder if this is a swim bladder issue. And the guy fires off like, well, their swim bladder doesn't go all the way to their tail. And I said, oh, really? He said, no, it's in their first part of their body. So I was like, oh, well, that's interesting. So I started doing some research and I found that's not completely true. So I can't come back and like, well, you're wrong. So basically I compiled all this information and shared it with him so that he could see like where we're at and why I'm saying what I'm saying. So it took a little bit of convincing, but eventually once I showed him things, basically the best ones I could find were these cartoon drawings of eels versus electric eels. And eels' bodies are basically confined to about, I'd say, 2/3 of their body than the rest of its tail. Eels are weird in that pretty much all their viscera is probably in the first third or less, but their swim bladder goes all the way to the very tip of their tail. So this very well could be a swim bladder issue. So these guys being obligate air breathers, they go up to the water column, gulp in air. When they gulp in air, that goes into their swim bladder. So this swim bladder is the complete length of this electric eel, which isn't the same in your regular eel species. Once we kind of got that all figured out, I was like, well, this definitely could be a swim bladder issue or like a foreign body that caused some kind of barotrauma to the swim bladder itself. So something that we ate or even like the parasite while it was digging its way through. The other thing we had an idea was if that infection was there at the very distal tail, it was producing gas. So at this point, kind of the next step is normally if this is any other fish, I would basically say, okay, let's take it out, sedate it, feel it, aspirate it, which basically sticking a needle into it and seeing, is there fluid? Is there air? Like what comes out? So on and so forth. Well, it's an electric eel. So you can't just stick your hand in there and pull it out, unfortunately.
I was going to ask, given the electric current, how do you interact with it? What if you stick your hand in the water? Are you going to get electrocuted? How does that work?
Sticking your hand in the water won't electrocute you necessarily, but essentially what they do is they come up in the water and then they put their body on you and then that creates the shock. And they're very quick. So I didn't really want to find that out.
Probably a good idea.
Yep. So what I did was, this is something I'd never messed with, and doing quick Google searches, you're not going to find much. So I went to VIN, which is Veterinary Information Network. And from there, there is a specialty center with aquatics. So I typed in electric eel and there was one other case that was sort of similar to mine, but not exactly. And through there, one of the moderators was a guy named Dr. Scott Weber. So I shoot him an email and I say, hey, do you have some time? Can I just chew your ear real quick on this case? He said, absolutely. So I gave him this huge information on this and he gave me his thoughts. And that's where a lot of my differentialist or my problem list came from, was things that he talked to me about. And then the next question was, it's like, how do I handle this? He sent me a paper by Dr. Pohl from the Shedd Aquarium on how they sedated their electric eels. So that gave me the dosages that I needed and what I needed to do. And the only other thing I didn't know exactly what I could do was when to handle. And he said, we'll use a voltmeter so you know when you can touch them. But he didn't tell me like what voltage was fine to touch them. He said, just use rubber gloves and everything else. Well, if you ever use rubber gloves, I mean, they're thick, and trying to like hold syringes or anything aren't going to work. And then I was Googling, and then I found out that Georgia Aquarium actually worked with electric eels. And I had some contacts with Georgia Aquarium through Aquavet 3. So I contacted Dr. Tanya Klaus. She said, oh, well, one of our other doctors, Dr. Chelsea Anderson, just did a talk with IAAAM on an air embolism that they had with one of the electric eels. So Dr. Anderson actually sent me her presentation and said, this is exactly what we did with the electric eel. The only thing she couldn't tell me again was the voltage. But pretty much I use everything that Dr. Anderson gave me as far as the induction route, how to create the our storage tub that I sedated in, rubber gloves to use, and everything else. So she pretty much gave me the plan. So I work a lot of overnights, or at least I did when I was in Oklahoma City. So on my downtime, I was on eel alert. So I started Googling and I found a researcher out in South America, and he was working with eels, and he actually says it's safe to touch them after less than 10 volts. So I was like, glorious. I finally have it. I remember emailing the aquarist at like probably 4 a.m. and I said, I have it. I know what we're going to do. So anytime I work with any fish, I always make up a plan so that I at least know what materials I need to take. And then it's kind of a checklist to make sure I did everything. So on November 5th of 2020, we had two guys trying to fish out this eel. And then our goal was initially to weigh it. And the way I was going to weigh it was kind of like one of those baggage weights. Then the next thing was, well, how am I going to sedate it? And what are we going to use? Because in the Georgia Aquarium, they had this fancy plexiglass airtight sealed thing. And I was like, well, I don't have that. So again, thinking outside the box, my wife works now with a container store. So I know tons about containers. So I was like, well, let's just use one of those under the bed containers. So got one of those, put the eel in there, and I just filled it up as high as it would go. So I just remember we sat there. I put in a bunch of MS-222 and I told the guy, I said, it's going to take a while. And I just remember he was getting antsy. He said, I can still breathe. What do we do if it doesn't work? I said, because I have time. And about, I think 13, 15 minutes finally went down. And then what I had him do was, he had the rubber gloves and he got a voltmeter, and we got an AC and a DC current voltmeter because I had no idea of which current it used because none of the papers I could find told you. So basically what you do is you put one probe on the nose and the other probe on the tail, and then you just wait for the reading. And I believe it was in DC currents is what ended up working for us to actually see it. Because at first we were using AC and I was like, it's not showing anything. And then we switched it over and like, oh, perfect. So it was actually pretty cool to see because as it was getting more and more sedate, you could see that number just going down. So once it was less than 10, that's whenever I took off the rubber gloves. I still had latex gloves on, took a deep breath and just picked up the tail. Didn't get shocked. But yeah, I was able to do the full physical exam. So all this took, man, probably at least a week and a half of seeing the fish visually. And then for us to actually get all the information for me to actually see it, which is a long time, way longer than it should have. During that time, those large bulbous areas that look like worms actually ruptured. And when it ruptured, at that point, whenever I was talking to Dr. Anderson, she had recommended starting cefpodoxime, which is a type of oral antibiotic. And the eel was still eating. So during this week and a half, we're doing oral antibiotics. So even though it ruptured, it didn't look like it was infected. It was actually starting to heal. So by the time I was looking at that wound, on one side, I think it was the right side, it hadn't ruptured. On the left side, it had ruptured, but it looked like it was starting to heal. So I cultured it. And then I also took a biopsy. So it's called a punch biopsy, where I took a little piece of the tissue, put it in formalin, and sent it off. And then on the other side where it hadn't ruptured, I went ahead and just took, I think, two more biopsies just to be safe. And then after I did that, We gave it an antibiotic injection, vitamin C and vitamin B. At that point, that's whenever we decided to recover it. So we had another tank with water. And then what I used is a power head. So basically it just forces water. So I had the aquarist holding the eel and then the power head in front of its mouth and just forcing water through its mouth, out through its gills to help kind of wake it up. It was very nerve-wracking because at that time I had the eel in this suction tank. So it was a high amount of anesthetic. Ideally, what you want to do is sedate them in that and then put them in something else. Again, this is a small production with just me and one other aquarist. Ideal world, I would have had another tank that I could have done that was lower, and then I would have had more hands. Again, I just didn't have that luxury. I did what I could. So recovery took a while. It took about 20 minutes. And the whole time, the guy's just looking at me like, it's not moving. And I was like, just keep it on there. Just keep it on there. And probably like 15 minutes in, it started kind of wiggling. I was like, oh, thank God. And it recovered fine, prolonged recovery, which scared me half to death, but it did fine. And then we ended up moving it back into the tank. So story doesn't end there, unfortunately.
I was going to say, if you leave the story there, I am sitting here in suspense. I really thought it was going to be the worms. You didn't see any worms. So now I'm like, is it bacterial? Like what other type of thing is happening here?
Yeah, so we'll just keep going. So I sent off the bacterial cultures and then the histo. So on bacteria, we got a lot of stuff that grew. The big one that they saw was what's called Aeromonas hydrophilia, which is a type of bacteria. And I've had one bacteriologist that worked with fish. He said, if you're looking for Aeromonas, he said, it's very common to see. So I think there were like three different things that were growing, but they said this is the one that was probably causing the most issues. So we grew that out and then they gave me what's called a sensitivity. So basically they tested different antibiotics, and then you find the one that it's going to be most susceptible to. So once we figure that out, the one that we were on, the cepodoxime, came back as not enough information. When it's not enough information, basically that means it could be susceptible, it could not. At that point, that's when we're like, well, we need to switch to a different antibiotic. So we ended up switching to what's called enrofloxacin or Baitril, if you've heard of that. And then as far as the histo, so there's inflammation in the skin, so the dermis layer, the panniculus, which is again a part of the skin, and myositis, which is the muscle. And all of that is severe to chronic. And there is a lot of edema or fluid built up and ulceration and a lot of degeneration of the muscles. But the Aeromonas most likely is probably secondary. So I still don't know what the primary thing is. So during this time, after we had done the exam, I got an update. The tail was actually all the way to the bottom of the tank. Fish was doing fine. Was eating the tablets of Enro or Baitril very well. And the plan was, is that open wound that had bursted open was that we would eventually close it. But I wanted to give the fish time to de-stress and then for us to come up with a better plan of once we take it out, where we can put it and everything else. The one thing that was noted was on the other side where it hadn't ruptured and I did the biopsies, I had closed them all up, but there was bubbles, like air bubbles coming out of there, which is odd. So that part still confuses me. Is a swim bladder connected to that area or was there gas producing bacteria? Well, within 4 days of that update, that one wound completely healed. So I was like, oh, cool. I don't have to worry about it. But they started noticing the tail started coming buoyant again. I was like, oh, then the eel stopped eating. And I was like, oh, you're kidding me.
Oh no.
Yeah. So if you've ever used Baitril or Enro in dogs, it can cause GI upset. So I was like, geez, like I bet you it's not eating because of that. Again, if this was in a hospitalized tank, we could do injections. With Enro, you can sometimes give fish injections every 3 days or sometimes even 48 hours, so every 2 days. So we wouldn't have to say much and we already know what we needed to do. They just didn't have the facility to do that. So I was like, we can try a bath treatment. Baths help, but they're not the end all be all, unfortunately. So we use metronidazole baths. So basically we would add it to the tank for a prolonged immersion for at least 3 days. And I was just crossing my fingers that hopefully it would help. And then what we were trying to do also was instead of giving the Enro one tablet twice a day, we were going to just do it two tablets once a day. About 5 days later, still anorexic and the tail was just slowly going up more and more. And there's so much I wanted to do. It just, they didn't have the facilities and the staff. Well, on November 29th, they found the eel deceased that morning, unfortunately.
No.
Yeah, I know. It's definitely not a fairy tale ending, which I absolutely hate. And that day I went over there to take a look at it and they asked me just to do like a brief necropsy. As far as internal organs, everything looked fine. I didn't see anything that jumped out at me, but the tail end was pretty nasty. That wound that had healed up, you could see that it was starting to heal up and almost closed off. But right when I opened it, all you could see was just really hemorrhagic and bruised muscle. And then you'd see just like these pockets, these little air pockets. So I'm assuming that's where the gas was. It was hard to tell where the swim bladder started and ended. There was just so much inflammation in that area. I'm assuming most likely it succumbed to sepsis. So I will say, just like with anything, with cases like this, I learned more from the ones that you lose than the ones that you save sometimes. You really kind of step back and you think, well, what could have changed? What could I have done better? And a lot of this were just limitations of, one, my knowledge of this species, two, how long it took for me seeing it to figuring out how in the world do I even touch it? If I could have figured out some of this stuff sooner, I probably could have done more things. And the other part were just things that were out of my control. They didn't have a hospitalization tank. If we could have just done injectables, I think as far as not eating and everything, it would have helped us. And then also, it is a very cool case and something I learned a lot from, but I learned to ask a lot more questions before getting into something like this, and especially asking of like the staff and what they have available. Overall, a very cool case, something that a lot of people have never really worked with.
No, what a crazy case. I mean, super cool history and just getting to hear the whole progression of you're trying for treatment. So lots to think about here.
Oh, yeah. New things popped up and things that I have no idea if like most of the, if the worm history part was a part of it or not, or was it a red herring or just interesting. And yeah, I truly wish it would have ended the other way, because it's one of the things where after we did the treatment and it was looking better, I was like, yes, I fixed it. And then, yeah, it just went the other way, unfortunately.
Well, such an incredible case, so much to learn from. Thank you so much for sharing the story of Frankie the Electric Eel. And Dr. Martinez, thank you so much for being on Aquadocs.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure and I'm glad I got to share some of my journey and then also this really cool electrifying case with everyone.
And that's going to do it for this week's episode of Aquadocs. I'd like to thank Dr. Robert Martinez for being on the show this week, our sponsors WAVMA and AAFE, as well as all of you, our wonderful listeners, for tuning in. As always, check out our Facebook and Instagram to stay up to date on the latest Aquadocs news. And if you've got an extra moment, please rate us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts and leave a review. I'm Michelle Greenfield. Stay healthy, stay safe, and we'll see you next time here on Aquadocs.